There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for another Atomic Show. My guest today is Zeon Leitz, the author of Energy is Life, and a former guest on the Atomic Show. Geez, it's been about 6 years ago that we spoke about her initial conversion from an anti-nuclear activist to become one of the world's most aggressive and out there public advocates for nuclear energy. Welcome to the show, Zeon.
Hi, it's good to be back. And yeah, it does feel like a really long time ago. Lots happened since then.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit. At the time we talked back in, I think it was the summer of 2020, which was, gosh, right after the world started shutting down from the COVID crisis, or actually had already shut down. We talked about your experience in being a spokesperson for Extinction Rebellion, which was a very active and aggressive, I guess maybe still are, group that was fighting to get the world's attention about climate change. And, mm-hmm. and you had an interesting experience that caused you to say, why are these guys fighting nuclear energy?
Right. So I started out as anti-nuclear because, you know, I spent a lot of time in these groups, and that was a very common perspective to have. And I did actually change my mind before I was in Extinction Rebellion. I was questioning quite a lot, but it's quite difficult. It's quite difficult to have those conversations in groups where there's a consensus, you know, that something's bad. So I was kind of trying to push back a little bit while questioning. Anyway, by the time it came around to Extinction Rebellion, I'd actually stepped away from a lot of the previous groups that I'd been involved in because of their attitude towards nuclear specifically, but also other technologies. But when they invited me to come on board as a spokesperson, they basically said, look, we just want you to talk about the science. And I thought, well, that's a good thing if they're going to allow that. And it's probably better that I'm doing it than, you know, some of their other spokespeople. But then it perhaps inevitably, I basically clashed with one of the other spokespeople because he made a claim that billions of people were going to die from climate change. And that was on television. It was all over the news. And I separately, some months later, was invited to go on another popular TV show. It's what's called The Andrew Neil Show. And he expected me to defend that claim, and he asked me about it. And that was really the moment where I thought, you know, maybe these groups haven't evolved as much as I thought, because I couldn't defend it. And then he went on to talking about gas. What are we going to do to replace fossil fuels? I couldn't say nuclear. And of course, afterwards I was told by the Extinction Rebellion people, well, you should have said renewables. And I said, well, I thought we were against all these technologies. You know, there's a lot of picking and choosing going on there, because officially the group doesn't have a view on either, but obviously that, you know, there are views there. I knew what they were. I knew I was there as a spokesperson. But yeah, that experience really caught me. You know, that I think the press described it as a rabbit in the headlights moment. Because there's this horrible screenshot of me just looking blank. Like, I just realized in that interview, live on TV, millions of viewers, I just can't do this anymore. You know, I need to be able to talk about solutions. I need to be able to talk about nuclear. I need to be able to say, no, that other person said something wrong. And I couldn't, because he was part of the in-group. But he did say something wrong, you know. And so that was when I really stepped away from all of these groups. And you know, one of the first things I did when I did that was think, well, what if there are others like me? Maybe I should start a group that reflects, you know, pro-science environmental action and see if people come. And that was very successful. Yeah, for a while. And we did a lot of actions that I think helped to change the conversation about nuclear, especially in that kind of first year we hit the ground running.
What was that group?
Emergency Reactor. We started out calling ourselves Nuclear for Net Zero. We did get some press with that as well. But yeah, we ch changed, rebranded it. I worked with Robert Stone, of Pandora's Promise,
Yeah, he's a
and
movie
we,
producer. Is that right?
yeah, and we had a conversation, and we're like, well, maybe it needs, and also net zero has become has very negative connotations now among some groups, so we kind of threw some other phrases around, came up with emergency reactor, just because it's kind of, gets your attention, and I basically took those many years of activist skills, messaging, activism, the approaches to direct action, the kind of projections on government buildings, things that we did that were, copied the world over. We kind of just said, let's bring that over into this space because it's never existed here before, and maybe it will do something. I don't run it anymore. I feel like it served its purpose, but for a few years we did a lot. We went around, we did the actions, we did petitions, we did open letters to the government, getting them to switch their mind on nuclear here, which they did here. And yeah, we did public engagement stalls, handing out bananas. We did a protest outside the Greenpeace headquarters. We did a lot of stuff in just a couple of years. And by the end of that, the public opinion had shifted so much, not just from our experience of speaking to people, but the actual polls showed that in those last 2 years, people's opinions shifted in favor of nuclear. That yeah, I stopped doing it after that, which I think is a bit of a shame because I do still get people contacting me saying, "What group can I get involved in?" But there's only so much I can do. So, yeah, I let it go eventually.
Leon, tell us a little bit about why you are so passionate about science and particularly about making energy decisions based on the best science available.
I mean, I think, it's the best tool we have. It's the best thing we have to solve some of the world's biggest problems. And I think sometimes we forget that because so many of our problems have already been solved by science and technology. And yeah, we're almost too comfortable. But I don't really mean that in a negative way. I don't think people should, needlessly suffer. But there are still millions of people around the world who don't. And they don't have access to electricity. They don't have even, some of the really basic stuff like access to vaccines, access to clean water, the very basic stuff that we kind of take for granted. We only for most of human history, we lived in poverty. We only got to this stage because of science and technology, developing treatments, developing education, developing, all of the things that surround us that are basically products of technology. And so, I think there's a bit of a paradox there that when we become so comfortable with it and take it for granted, we don't realize that it's the foundation of everything. And I think energy especially is the foundation of civilization. Like everything comes back to energy. Whether you can produce these goods comes back to energy. Whether you can breathe well, live on a healthy planet comes down to where you get your energy from. So, that's the title of my book, Energy is Life. And, the reason for that is just trying to get people to step back a minute and think, well, what would life be like without all of these things that I've, for some reason, have started saying are too much or too damaging, or, they're bad because consumerism or capitalism, all the things that you hear that I still hear, that I still get, I'm doing a book tour at the moment and I still get questions like this. But Zion, shouldn't we go back to living how, we were when we lived on the land, simpler times? And really that's, that it's advocating for poverty. And there are millions of people who do anything to escape that kind of poverty. And I personally feel we have a moral duty to help lift those people out of poverty, or at least not get in their way as they're doing it, which they are doing it because there's, many countries are in the process of development, just like we did with our industrial revolution. And now you have world leaders and NGOs telling them, well, we don't want you to do that because you're burning a lot of coal. We want you to set net zero goals, etc. And it's just not really fair. And again, I think it's a product of having, it's the paradox of plenty. Like we have so much that it's almost hard to believe that others have so little, and there still needs to be a leveling up there, and B, none of us really truly want to live a life, you know, that is energy poor. Even if we romanticize it and we think, oh, it'd be so nice in a community on the land, that is poverty, that is scarcity. And that scarcity narrative comes from the most privileged people on the planet. So yeah, that's kind of, I feel like it's not, people often, you know, call me this kind of, oh, she's the nuclear person. It nuclear's part of it because it has to be part of it. Because if you want the solution, all right, let's be honest, what are the solutions? If you want clean, abundant energy, there are very few solutions. Like, you could say hydropower, fine, but not everywhere geographically has a lot of access to hydropower. What does that leave? That pretty much leaves nuclear. And you can have wind and solar, but you can't develop a civilization with wind and solar. You can supplement, you can add to the grid with it, sure. But really, if you want something as powerful as coal has been historically, then it has to be nuclear. And that's where I kind of landed with that, where I thought, well, actually, there's a lot of issues in the kind of the environmental movement, essentially, where this idea of scarcity came from, and this idea that, well, nuclear is bad because it just props up our current way of living, and our current way of living is bad.
And Zion, you know, I got to ask you, when you are talking about we, can you make sure people understand who you mean? Because as you said, there are many people in the world that wouldn't agree with what you just said when you talked about we. We have a lot. We have the technology. We have solved these problems.
Well, it is. I mean, it is everybody who's listening, isn't it? Because if you have access to a device that is run on electricity, that enables you to listen into a podcast, and you have time to do that because you're not out toiling in the fields in 40 degree heat trying to grow rice, then I'm talking to you, right? Because the
Well,
other people, you've read the books, you've
I
seen
know.
The other timeline, those people don't have access. And let me tell you, even when you give them access, so my parents have, you know, looked at these villages in India where the our family still resides, and has sent them things like money to buy a phone, right? So you think, wow, life-changing technology. Now they have access to banking. Now they have access to, you know, the internet. They can ask questions. They can try and get medical diagnosis, which, fine, you might say that's not perfect, but it's better when you have no doctors or healthcare at all. You know, fine, they have that device. But even then, if you are 4 hours from the nearest town where you can plug that in and charge it, you only have a finite amount of time per, you know, maybe 100 people in this village quickly going through and doing that. Okay, I'm checking my banking, or okay, I'm trying to find out what, you know, what my daughter might be sick with so I can work out how to treat her, blah, 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 all of that stuff. And then the phone dies. And then at some point, weeks later, someone will make that long trip into the town and they will recharge it there and bring it back home. They are not spending that time listening to podcasts. They are not.
Yeah.
This is millions of people.
And my question for those who you know, want to give somebody a device and say, now you got modern technology, is where does the service come from in those villages?
Exactly.
That is, I
Exactly.
mean, I travel around with a cell phone, and even here in America, there are many places where I get no signal.
Yeah,
I
they
guess
do.
I
I mean,
could
they don't.
subscribe
Yeah.
to Elon Musk's
Yeah.
Skynet or whatever he calls it,
They
but
don't. They don't get service. What they do is they use the phone in the town so that everyone will pool their ideas what you need to do, and then one person will go on a motorbike or even a bike, or, you know, however they can. I think when we were there, we actually traveled by mule at one point to this town. It was like this little kind of carriage that was drawn by a person who was occasionally around and would take you places, you know. It wasn't like a bus service that was always there anyway. And then you get into kind of the closest thing to, you know, a developed region, not super developed, but there are wires and plugs, and, you know, the wires are just hanging from the skies. It's all just very ad hoc. And then you'd charge your phone and you would be able to do stuff on it. But before that, people could do that anyway, because there would be computer, you know, computer cafes, which we used to have originally before mobile phones took off. It was a thing that you could go to a cafe and use a computer. Well, it wasn't a
I've been
cafe,
there.
but it
I've
was
been to
called,
one
yeah, right, yeah.
or two.
That's actually more normal. But the phone, obviously, you can save stuff to your device. So once you save it, say you Google everything and you look up like all these different pictures of someone being sick of something, you know, I don't know, a skin disease, lots of pictures of skin. You can save them all and you can go back to the village, you can look at them. So there's ways, you know, around the limitations, but it's a huge limitation. But yeah, what I'm trying to say is it gives you some access, and that access, just that small amount of access, you get back and the battery lasts for a few hours and you all look at all the stuff that's saved on there. Okay, that already is a great equalizer. That is one step, tiny step up the ladder, but you can't really have more until you have the development with the service, you know, with reliable access, with the ability to recharge your device and multiple devices, right? Like fridges and air conditioning and things that they don't have. And you know, obviously there's different levels of poverty and there are people who are that they have a little bit more than others, you know, and you know, my family there doesn't live in extreme poverty, but I saw extreme poverty when I was there, which just, you know, I mean, we all have a concept of what it's like, I think, but we're so far removed from it. You know, even I have to sometimes bring myself back and just think, okay, appreciate what you've got here, Zion, because you've, when I say we, that's if I have time to sit and watch a TV show or, you know, even read a book, that means I'm literate. That means I had education. Or, you know, write a book, goodness sake, or have this conversation with you using a device across the world, you know, then I'm talking about us. We are in the top percent of people in terms of privilege. We have everything. If you can plug in as many devices as you want into your house and run them, and you don't have to think twice about it, you know, you buy a new toaster, you buy a new kettle, you don't think twice about the electricity cost, then you are in that top percent. You are the most privileged person in the world. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. You know, I think we often hear privilege used in a negative way. I'm saying, wow, how lucky we are. But everybody needs this. And pretending that we went wrong somewhere, we should go back to living another way, that's dangerous, actually. That has had repercussions around the world where countries have planned for scarcity when they should have been planning for abundance. So in terms of thinking, well, everyone should have this rather than we went wrong somewhere, we should have less.
And one of the, I've been interested in following the abundance discussion and the abundance movement for a while. And I wrote an article several years ago. I learned that there's a surprising group of people who actually profit from scarcity and fight abundance. Not people that are nonprofits or people that are ideologically motivated, people who literally profit from abundance. Who can you imagine that might be in that category?
Who
I
profit
mean,
from
sorry,
abundance?
profit from fighting abundance. I misspoke. Profit from fighting abundance, from
Yeah,
imposing
sure.
scarcity.
I mean, many people, yeah, you know, I would say a lot of NGOs, a lot of the people that actually like live with abundance promote scarcity. There are plenty of academics I could name. There's one that just passed away recently, made his entire career off this, you know, and popularized this idea, helped to popularize this idea that people are bad, people are wasteful. Everyone else should live with less. But you know, those people that are making those arguments are never living with less themselves. And I do think a lot of the big organizations, the big in quotations environmental groups have profited as well. I mean, this is, you know, they promote, it's like a drug, isn't it? They promote it and then they get huge donations, enabling them to push forward that same agenda. And we've had that same argument and agenda for so long. It's only very recently that it's been pushed back,
Well,
are arguing for abundance.
I'm actually speaking of those who listen to the NGOs and say, wow, that person's or that group's message is really quite supportive of what I want to do. So I will give them a few millions so that I can profit by a few billions from what happens when there
Yeah, I
is
mean,
scarcity.
I know who you're talking about. I just don't want to get in trouble. I wrote an article about this recently. I did a bit of a deep dive on my Substack. It's all very, you know, it's all very fact checked. And it was looking at what happened in Germany specifically, and the main players, the key people who made the decision there to phase out nuclear, and their very clear, undeniable ties to fossil fuel organizations. That is not conspiracy. The links are drawn, and those are just the ones we know about where there's some evidence. You know, I think there's always been this kind of idea that, well, there are vested interests here who don't, they don't want nuclear. Nuclear solves too many problems. And yeah, a lot of these very powerful organizations worked to undermine energy security and climate goals by acting through people who had, you know, real agency, like world leaders, to go after this technology, and very successfully. And they were doing it, you know, before I was born. If you really look back at some of the funding links, even you know, Russia's been found to have funded environmental groups that have, fine, you know, they've protested fossil fuels, they've also protested nuclear, basically protesting modern society, but very successfully. You know, those movements led directly to policies that champion scarcity. And now we're starting to see the impacts of that, because we also had an energy crisis here, and suddenly the electricity is very expensive. People are starting to have to think about these things for the first time. And they're wondering, where did this narrative come from? Actually, it's all very traceable. I mean, I think there's probably a lot more that we can't, you know, prove, but where I've looked at something and thought, that person's arguments sound just like they came from, you know, something that I read somewhere else, but we can't draw those links. I can't draw those links because we don't have the solid evidence, but we know that it was, that it has been a real thing. Vested interests, funding, bad actors to completely shift the narrative on these life-saving technologies, very successfully, and using it very, you know, you, using it, I think there's a reason it's linked to environmental groups that took donations from these organizations, and also, you know, green, like in Germany, it was the Green Party, it was Green Party members, so it was always under this banner of environmentalism, and that's kind of what I was surrounded by for a long time, except I didn't really understand where it was coming from, you know, where the fear and where the narrative, and no, nobody did really, nobody questioned it. We just are against nuclear. If there was anyone in there who knew why, they weren't upfront about it.
It lack of being upfront about it is common. And one of the things that I've learned over the years is that the people who market products like oil, natural gas, non-NGO developed corn, rice, maize, whatever you want to talk about, those that compete with the products that could be enabled through thinking about and pursuing abundance. Those people have some extremely talented communicators who are very good at finding ways to address people's anxieties and take advantage of them. They're people who are well trained in what Edward Bernays used to talk about as propaganda. It's the same thing as marketing.
Yeah,
The
so
art of marketing.
yeah, there was that the NATO secretary who said that this was like 10 years ago or something. What was his name? Rasmussen, I think it was. And he, yeah, he basically, that's what he said. He used the word disinformation. He said that there's disinformation coming out of Russia towards European energy security, and the entire aim is to just shatter it. And you know, and it worked through environmental groups. And the reason, I think there's a couple of reasons there. One is they're always seen as the good guys, so that the least, they're the groups you'd least suspect. And even now that's true, right? Like these groups still get a lot of funding and donations from individuals who believe them to be the good guys, and from large organizations who, you know, similar reasons, like if you're giving to a charity, let's give to the environmental group. And the other reason, they do have some fantastic storytellers, but they're also very susceptible to misinformation. So a lot of them probably believed the disinformation. And I actually think that about some of the German Green Party people is that they believed it. And now they're coming out and saying, well, we were wrong. And I know that there's been a lot of pushback on that, people saying, you know, it's too late and it's your fault. But actually, I think some of those people were misled themselves because the disinfo campaign was so powerful. And like I said, you know, I believed a lot of these things myself, because it was just so ubiquitous. And everyone around me believed it. And society broadly didn't question it, as I'm sure you know, because you've been in this space for a long time. It's really only in recent years that we started questioning what is the actual truth about these technologies and what could we actually gain if we stopped protesting them? And then later, where did all of that come from? And there's so many links. You know, you've got Clinton saying that there was Russian funding. I mean, there were psyops everywhere. We know that Friends of the Earth was funded with oil money. We know that Greenpeace, you know, was promoting gas, green, claiming to be against fossil fuels while promoting its own gas company. Although I think they called it, what do they call it? Pro wind gas. So they were pretending that it was mostly wind, but it actually was mostly gas, which just tells you, know, actually, then they're not against that. They're not against fossil fuels. So what are they actually standing for? You know, it. Well, it's just making money, really, isn't it, at the end of the day?
Yeah. Well, I mean, interestingly enough, just from a purely business point of view, it is profitable for an oil company to fund somebody who's fighting oil. As long as that group fighting oil is fighting, say, development somewhere else on somebody else's field,
Right.
it's good
Yeah.
for us to keep the supply down. I mean, in the business press, or the business teaching and MBA school, they talk about that as being suppress or capital discipline. In other words, you don't want to produce too much. You don't want to invest too much because then
Yeah,
you'll
yeah.
produce too much and drive down your prices.
Right,
Yeah.
yeah. And that's the thing, right? Imagine if every country had done what France did in the 80s. Every country built lots of nuclear reactors. Every country mostly weaned off of fossil fuels as far as they could. You know, I know it sounds like beautifully utopian, but there was a moment where that could have happened, where there were, you know, some countries pivoted against and some went for. And France is a good example of what could have been achieved again before I was born, could have been achieved. You think, well, there's no way that everybody just, you know, automatically just decided not to go, not to have that future. There's no way everybody collectively just suddenly decided like that was a campaign when you really think about it. And I've heard people say, well, no, Zion, it's because of 3 Mile Island, but no one died at 3 Mile Island. No, Zion, it's because of Fukushima. No one died because of the meltdown. And fine, I'm not saying there were no repercussions from that, but there are far worse disasters from, you know, hydropower, right? Hundreds of thousand people killed because of the Bankou Dam collapse in China. How come we didn't have a huge global movement against hydropower and shut all the dams down? How come when Challenger exploded and Columbia exploded, we didn't have a huge pushback against the space industry, which, by the way, you know, is very polluting. I'm all for the space industry, but it is very polluting if that's what you're saying you don't like about nuclear technology. How come we didn't have that global pushback? They just carried on. It was, you know, there's a lot more going on there than just, well, it's an innate fear. And I still hear people say that, well, it's natural to be afraid of it. No, I don't think it is, unless people keep telling you stories that like promote your fear. And again, I do think there are a lot of bad actors that were involved, but we can't link them. We can't say they were directly linked, but I've looked at some of the how powerful their narratives have been, and I've just thought that's not just being afraid, that is propaganda. I give you one example. It's that German book, if you haven't heard of it, it's called Die Wolke,
Yes.
translates
Yeah.
to the cloud. Have you read it?
It's
Because
required reading though, isn't it?
it's
For
required reading in German schools. And let me tell you, when I read that book recently, and I'm no longer anti-nuclear, it made me afraid because I don't want to read about a little kid, a girl, right, who She's near this nuclear power plant, and it's very specifically described as a nuclear power plant. It's not weapons, it's a power plant, and it goes into detail about how actually people didn't want it to be built there because they knew that it was going to cause an apocalypse. It then explodes, it causes an apocalypse. This little kid watches everyone around her die from radiation poisoning, watches her friends die, goes into like a makeshift hospital and sees, and it's described in detail. It's graphic. I wouldn't let my kids read this book, at this age that they're in Germany. And it's so graphic, the eyes are falling out, and like it's just hor it's hor it's horrible. It's traumatizing. And
But as you said, it can't be truthful because we have 70 years worth of history.
right. And it but it's I mean it's proper that book is propaganda. That book has won many awards. That's why it's on the German curriculum. I have spoken to Germans like recently who have said to me, like if the science communicator Sabine Hossenfelder, she said
Yes,
it
I know
traumatized
that.
her as a kid. She went into great detail about how it traumatized her. Now she's a physicist. She is not against nuclear power, but it affected everybody because it was somehow someone somewhere decided to put it on the curriculum. But in the first place, this author decided to write this book, and she was awarded for it, many, many awards. And again, this was around the 80s. And there's no way anyone can read that book and tell me it's not propaganda. There's no way. And the entire message is, well, that's what you get for building the power plants. And it's written like that. It's like a reflective way where it says, wow, we were warned. We made this decision. It's evil. It's the fact that that's taught to kids, it's just shocking. There's no amount of teaching them science at the same age that will overcome that storytelling. No
Yeah,
amount. It's
now
the
here's a here's
most beautiful piece of propaganda when you actually look at it. But who put that in place there? Why was it really written? There's a lot of questions I have that haven't been answered.
Yeah. And here's another way to look at the idea of whether it's innate is I have six grandchildren, and when they were very young, they're not quite as young now, but when they were very young, maybe in the 4 to 7 year age group, I talked to them about I've been talking to them about nuclear a long time, that people shouldn't be surprised about that. But I talked to them and they had no thought one way or another. There's nothing innate about being afraid of nuclear. It's not like, the oven, which one or two of them have touched and burned their hands, and say, oh, yeah, I don't like flame. It's just something that it's not innate. Everything is learned about nuclear. And so we can be taught to be afraid. We have been taught to be afraid, but it didn't come naturally. There's nothing
Taught, yeah.
automatically scary about the
And
term or
taught.
even the ideas.
And if you think about it, I mean, this is kind of how I approached nuclear advocacy when I came into it. It was, we need to tell better stories, we need better messaging, we need to go after press, we need to make sure they're talking about it, we need like all the different kind of avenues. That's exactly what they did. And sometime around the 80s, before that probably, but that book came out in the 80s, at the same time as negative press reporting. Okay, fine, they could do that because of things like Chernobyl, so they had lots of reason, lots of reason to build on it and to make it into an even scarier story. Then you had lots of pop culture, and I know Simpsons always gets mentioned, but again, the only depiction that I can think of, a new even now, of a nuclear power plant worker in popular television is The Simpsons, and the owner is the most evil person in the show, right, Mr. Burns. Germany, they had this book, Die Welt. There was such an assault. When you really look at it, there was such an assault of pop, like media, both reporting, fictional books, fictional TV programs, and also a number of programs that I watched or films that I watched that were post-nuclear apocalypse, but they never distinguished between a bombs and energy. And that was deliberate because they could easily have said it's because of a bomb, but they never did that because they wanted you to have an association of they're the same thing. And that's exactly what Die Welt tells you, right? Like it's the same thing. And if I didn't know now, if I didn't know better, I would read that and think, wow, yeah, we shouldn't build these because they're that dangerous. Whereas obviously now I understand that it's nothing like a bomb, but it doesn't matter because if you hear the same story again and again and again, someone explaining that to you is not going to override the feelings that of and the fear that you've developed from such an assault on your, on your, the way that you understand, the way that you relate to this technology.
Now, of course,
Which is why,
we're
it helps to be able to overcome that by meeting actual nuclear, because we're seeing an actual power plant. But how many people actually do that or have that opportunity?
The challenge I have always had with people that point to The Simpsons or any other fictional work is I've been a reader my whole life, and I never have trouble separating my responses to fiction versus my responses to a nonfiction book like yours. One is a creative story designed to purposely exhibit or extract emotion and response and excitement and trembling or whatever it is, horror films, whatever you do. But those are fiction. Why do people, devote or take inspiration for decision making from fiction? That's just my own
I mean,
issue. Now,
but I think that's always been the case. Like, from the beginning of language, we listen to the storytellers. We believe the storytellers, even if they're telling us crazy stories about gods in the sky and how this, this constellation is a story about a god who did something bad, and that's why they're sitting, Cassiopeia sitting in a chair, rotating. All of those stories, well, how we learn to relate to each other in the world for a long time, right? In
I
I'm talking
suppose.
early humans, you develop language. That's where the early stories come from. We still use those. Our days of the week are still named after stories from Greek mythology. They were so influential. Now the stories changed over time, but the stories are still there, and they might not even be deliberate. Matt Groening may not have even done that deliberately. He just picked up on something in culture. Here's how people see this. Let's run with it. It's funny. But it just reinforces a stereotype. And stereotypes are very powerful and very hard to overcome once that feeling's there that you have about another group or another person or technology is very hard to push back on that. Again, data won't do it. You need better stories to do it. You need a better storyteller to be able to do it. The numbers won't change people's minds. They
All
never
right.
have
So,
done, and they probably never will.
here's another question for you. You and I are both very strong advocates of nuclear development and building new plants and producing more power from nuclear. But your book also talks about the real importance of things like clean cooking fuels for those who live in places where nuclear is never going to be a solution or not going to be a solution anywhere in the near future. How does building nuclear plants in the developed areas of the world help those who have nothing today? How does it get fuels to them or get to them maybe access to power or tanks of propane or whatever it might be? Is there
Yeah, so
a
we saw the direct issue with this in the energy crisis very recently, because when Germany shut its nuclear power plants and was then relying on more gas, and suddenly everywhere was, we were all scrambling, the prices were going up. It was developing countries that were pushed out because they couldn't afford it at all. And no one really talks about that or realizes that, but that did happen. The invisible things that happen all the time that we don't realize. And at the same time, we now, if we didn't have climate change and we didn't know about air pollution, then it wouldn't matter, and we'd still be wanting these countries to develop, and they could burn as much coal as they want, which is the che it is the best option, right? If you're poor, burning wood, burning coal, these are your cheapest options. If you get a bit up the ladder, you can go to gas, you can get other sources. But there's a reason why, we burned a lot of these fuels in the Industrial Revolution. It's cheap, it's plentiful. But obviously, it's dirty. People don't care if it's dirty. If they're trying to escape poverty, they don't care. They'll use it anyway, and they'll be coughing their lungs up, but they'll use it anyway because it's better than not being able to eat, right? So, I think it just comes down to realizing that, we are very connected, and our actions influence what happens in the rest of the world. And you could also argue our development helped lead to climate change, but We still haven't really fixed that because most of us are still burning a lot of fossil fuels. Now, if you're in one of the more wealthy countries, there's no reason to have a dirty electricity grid. There's just no reason. Fine, you're going to need some oil, you're going to need some gas. I'm not saying they completely go away, but we could all have gotten to a decarbonization level as France. And if we had done that, climate change wouldn't be as bad as it is, air pollution wouldn't be as bad, and there'd be a lot less stress and strain on other countries. And it's counterintuitive, but the more fossil fuels we allow them to burn to develop quickly, the less they'll need later. Because once you reach a certain level of development, that's when you can pivot and say, I'm going to use cleaner fuels. And that is gas initially, later nuclear. And those countries know that, right? The countries that didn't have this disinformation campaigns in the East, they haven't had these issues with nuclear. They don't have overburdensome regulations. I'm talking about China, Japan, South Korea, right? India. India set up a nuclear program in the 50s. In the 1950s, India tried to set up a nuclear program. Because they were hopeful, if thorium comes on, if thorium is around the corner and someone creates a thorium reactor, we have an abundance of thorium and we're going to be set for life. So they actually put money into developing nuclear know-how around that, and they still have some expertise in that area. It's just that they didn't really have the financial means to, build 50 plus reactors like France did. They didn't have that capability. But even decades ago, they were thinking ahead, how do we actually get there? We need to have some kind of program in place. And they do still have that in place, so that if thorium suddenly comes on the market, if there's suddenly a reactor, I know China's claiming that they've made one, but no one's seen the blueprints yet, then they will jump on that. They will jump on that because they've been waiting, and they know that they shouldn't be burning a lot of coal. They know, because you can see it in the statistics for the respiratory issues. You can see it walking around and seeing people cough, right? Because the air is so polluted. It's so dirty. It's not just from fossil fuels, but a lot of it is. Some of it's also just dirty vehicles. They know, so they will take the options the second that option's there. But that option isn't just solar panels and wind turbines. That's the issue, is that we're now selling them. And again, when I say we, that's Western governments and Western NGOs are selling them. Wind and solar can do this. You can just do it with that, because that's what we want, because, that's ideologically driven.
I think that I read something recent, well, probably a couple of years ago now, where a small town or village in India had been given solar panels by an NGO, and the village said, "We really don't want these. We want real electricity." This is kind of an interesting response, because obviously
And
the
it's, there's other issues that nobody wants to talk about because they don't want to sound anti-wind and solar. And there's definitely those people out there. Look, fine. But I read a paper recently about a study in Zambia where they found, fine, that they had been given these solar panels. They had generated some electricity for some time. And again, if there's nothing else that you can possibly have in that region, fine. I'm not saying that's a bad idea, but they have no way to dispose of them. So, and when I was, if I visit my parents' village in India, if they have any waste, they don't tend to have waste, right? Because they don't really have a lot of goods that you would burn, but they will just burn anything that's left over. So if we left rubbish there, they would just burn it. They wouldn't even know, not to burn something that's plastic. Like, they will just burn it because they have nowhere to put it. So they're either burning or putting these, just piling, piling the solar panels up once they're not working anymore in landfill sites. So it's almost irresponsible to sell or give these panels to these regions if you're not going to go and take them away at the end of the life cycle, or have something, something inbuilt there, like you do with nuclear waste management, that you will put it somewhere and take it away and manage it. That's got to be in. But then obviously that would drive up the cost, wouldn't it? And so the biggest incentive is the cost. And so if you remove that.
You got to do full costing of things, and I'm not opposed to any form of energy, but I just think we need to have honest discussions about the pluses and minuses and limitations. Something, I mean, I'm never going to have a nuclear powered car, although I could have a nuclear power system and charge an electric car. That'd be perfect. I mean, nuclear plants do, as people say, like to run full out. They are not designed to be very responsive to changes in power demand, or they know that they lose, they don't make as much money if they are. But connect up nuclear power plants with a battery, big battery, it's starting to sound pretty good because batteries are real good at going up and down in power.
That's
But
the thing,
anyway.
there's no perfect solution to anything. Like all of these technologies about how well you use them and what the trade-offs are. But my entire argument and what brought me to nuclear is not just like I'm a stan for the technology, which a lot of people seem to be fine. You know that's what they want to do. For me, it's what it can solve if we use it the right way, because there isn't a lot that what is that on par with? Probably, the mechanization and development of agriculture is probably on par with that, being able to feed so many people. Well, we also need to put energy in with that. Like, yeah, you can feed lots of people, shelter, water, fine. We know those are the essentials, but we don't think about energy in that way, and we should, because it's the foundation of all of that stuff. Everything
It's
else,
life. It's life, isn't it?
it really is. And I have had pushback on this. People say, no, we can live without. We used to live without. No, we don't. No, we can't. Please go and visit a region where people are living without electricity, or even where they're living with some, intermittent, because the difference, it will blow your mind. And I've tried to put that across in the book, by showing some of the life in one of these villages and imagining what it would be like to have lived that lifeline. And the lack, I often say to people, it's not even just about, there's a lot of discussion about immigration at the moment, some of it quite nasty. And I've noticed in recent years, as the conversations change, I've noticed people say to me, oh, well, your parents were economic migrants. And I think that's interesting, because I'd never heard that before. It was not the way that it was thought of before. They came to fulfill a need. Had a dearth of workers. They needed manual factory workers. My parents came in here and did their entire lives till they retired. But now suddenly they're seen as, oh, well, they were taking advantage of a system. And I'm thinking, fine, they weren't fleeing war. Like, you can't, that's what you're saying. They didn't have to come here. They weren't fleeing war. But if you live in those circumstances, if you are energy poor and you live in poverty, that is a war on human dignity. That is a type of war that we never have to experience. And just because you might enjoy going off grid camping for a few days does not mean that you understand what that lifestyle is like. It's not even possible, I don't think, for us to understand, because the lack of autonomy is something that we just do not have. The lack of agency is just something we do not have, because we have not had to deal with a war on dignity. Even with current struggles, as we all have them, of course, it's on a different scale. And that, my whole thing has always been caring about that, and a moral obligation to end energy poverty and to try and, lift people up, because I really think, you've got immense human capital just going to waste there, because they can't even put food on the table. And I think, that's what makes us a good species. We care about each other. We try to improve some of these things, incrementally, and we've been very successful at it. But at some point, this propaganda and this narrative got in the way of that, and so I'm trying to bring us back on track. That's the way I approach it. It's not even about just nuclear. If something better came up tomorrow, I would be advocating for that, right? But there isn't anything better. It is the best solution. All of these countries need a lot of reactors in the long run. And it also secures employment. It secures, expertise and other things that will help with the development that many countries are lacking at the moment. And actually, if you help them get there, or don't stand in the way when they get there, you won't get people fleeing to your country, because they'll be happy where they are. My parents would have loved to have stayed with their own family, but what they love more is being able to feed their own kids and
I
not
think you,
toil in fields.
in your book, you talked about the thought initially, or maybe the dream that your parents had of someday retiring back to their home, and then deciding that that just wasn't feasible.
My entire childhood, they dreamed, right? They dreamed going back to the village. And as the years went on, they lost people. Uncles and aunts died, right? Some from natural causes, some from things that here would be preventable, because they don't have the vaccines, they don't have, the medication, access to medication and things like that. Some from snake bites. Even so, they dreamed, and it was only after they retired, when I said, "Well, are you going back?" that they admitted, and I think it was a very sad thing for them to admit, because they didn't want to admit that they had the choice, and their choice was not to go back to the family. Both of them, hundreds of family members, that you just can't go back to living that way once you have lived with a level of agency. Because, I found it difficult, and I was only in this village for 3 weeks, but I found it difficult to watch, kids running barefoot when there are snakes everywhere. Snakes live in the long grass. They don't have a way to mow the grass. They can't really keep on top of it. It's very wild. Lots of wild animals, lots of things that will bite you. And actually, if you look this up, the statistics are terrible. Like, lots of people in these countries die from snake bites.
Wow.
It's unthinkable here, right? We think, when we think nature, well, I mean, what do we think? We think, oh, isn't it lovely? We need more nature. I'm not disagreeing with that, but the people who live in nature don't like it, because it means that you'll get bitten, and then you won't get treated, because you're 4 hours from the nearest hospital. And even if you go there, they expect you to pay up front. They won't just treat you. Literally, there are people dying on the steps. I saw that when we were there in Delhi, passing hospital, and I said, why are there so many people just lying on the steps in 40-degree heat? They look sick. And my dad said they can't get treated because they can't pay. And I said, well, can't they just treat them? And then, and then he said, no, there's no money. They can't do it. And I said, I'm looking at people who are dying. And he was like, yeah. And when we were on the roads, you saw people on the side of the road who'd been hit by cars, also very common there. They don't have traffic lights. It's a bit crazy on the roads there. And you just see people with limbs missing, kids. You'd see kids. And again, I'd say, and I remember, because I found it very difficult, I would say, can we help them? And they're just, my parents would just be like, there are millions of people like that. You can't help them. The best we
Certainly
could do,
can't help.
we'd give them a few rupees. It's pennies to us, it's money to them. But this doesn't solve the problem. The problem is not solved by giving a few solar panels, or even giving money, or even giving a phone. The problem is solved by development and access to reliable electricity, regular, reliable, cheap electricity. That's the only thing that will ever change any of that. So that
You know, we've
heartbreak that I felt when I saw those things, I've channeled it into this, because this is the
yeah.
solution. Giving them a few rupees might make me feel better, but it won't solve the problem.
And one of the things that is happening that is encouraging to me, particularly in India, is that India does have a rather large program of developing more nuclear power plants, some with their own indigenous technology of the heavy water, pressurized heavy water reactor, and some with imported technologies. And there is a very small company in the US that has developed a thorium and uranium fuel specifically designed for heavy water reactors like those in India. So stay tuned. There may be some
I mean,
improvements along the way.
they've been trying to do it for ages. They won't have the hesitation that we've had in the US, in the UK, across Europe. They won't have that. They're ready to go. They just need a bit more time to get there, I think. But things will change so quickly there, because I also think people really underestimate human capital. There were people I saw there. There was ingenuity I saw there that I just couldn't even imagine. Like, people who'd lost limbs, who'd made makeshift skateboards out of just piles of rubbish they found. And I think they're literally inventing the wheel. These are kids. Wires hanging everywhere. Yeah, in the towns, there's wires hanging everywhere. That's because they've worked out a way without, think about it, no education, not even necessarily able to read and write. Like, high levels of illiteracy in these regions. All my family, they're illiterate. Of course they are. They don't have access to education. They don't have pencils and pens. They don't have, anyway. And somehow they've managed to make these things and make makeshift wheelchairs out of rubbish, and wire things up so that they can occasionally, like, it's incredible. The ingenuity is incredible. I think if you give those people access to just a little bit, they're going to run with it. They're going to change the world. Such a spirit of just, how do we make life better? How do we do it? Let's run. But then it's a lack of, resources at the moment. But if they can, they are, then that they know that. That's why they're trying to build nuclear reactors. But if they really kind of get to a point where they, if they get to that point of development where there's just enough, more people can leave the villages. They can leave behind the hard, farming lifestyles. Is what my family are over there, rice farmers. They can leave that behind and they can actually apply themselves. And you know what? Then they can go on podcasts and they can listen to podcasts and they can have the agency. Can you imagine? I
They
actually
can
think
join we. They
global
can join. They can
superpower.
become. They can
It could
become part of we, as
be
you and I.
incredible. It could be incredible. Well, they should be part of we. But I also think, just it will be like we were before we fell for the propaganda. But they will not fall for this propaganda, right? They will not fall for the scarcity narrative because they've been too close to it. And yeah, imagine
Yeah.
that earlier, the early people who were really, I don't know them, I've read about it, when nuclear was first, a thing, when it became a thing, someone split the atom, now someone's making a reactor. There was so much excitement, and people were talking about nuclear power cars. They were so excited. That's how they're talking there, but they just don't have it at their fingertips there. Not yet. But you've got
Yeah.
engineers who have no training, who are just, they're engineers, they've worked things out. And unleash those Einsteins on the world, because I think it will benefit everyone. It will benefit human capital globally to lift these people out of poverty.
You know, I love the use of the word human capital. I used to get some pushback from people in the various organizations I was in. They said, you shouldn't be talking about people like that. And I said, I want you to think about this from the point of view of a capitalist. A capitalist, if they see something that's worthwhile, they invest in it, they develop it. It becomes something that they really will spend time and effort on. And that's what education is, and buying pencils for people is investing in human capital, the people and their wonderful potential to be. And of course, good thing about humans is they have their own brains, and they don't need to be programmed. They can
Yeah.
learn and develop and innovate,
But also,
but they do need help.
it gives us direction, right? Like, we all, let's be honest, and I have asked this to people in my Q&As when they say they want to go back to living a certain way of life, or not go back, because obviously they haven't actually lived that way of life, but shouldn't we all live in a commune on the land? And I've, what would you spend your time doing? Would you rather spend 3 hours a day collecting firewood so that you can use your little cooker, your little stove to cook food, toiling in 40 degree heat in a farm, on the farm,
I'm going to interrupt
or
you for a
in rice
second.
paddies?
I want to interrupt you for a second. Because we're talking to an American audience who often is illiterate about centigrade versus Fahrenheit, people need to understand 40 degrees is 104 degrees Fahrenheit. It's pretty freaking hot. Go ahead.
Yeah, and actually, that's just like an average summer. So when they have a heat wave, it's so deadly. It's so deadly. And there's no shade, there's no shelter, there's no air con. Again, not without electricity. There's no air con in the villages. And imagine you're doing that for several hours a day. Is that really what you want? And then you gotta wash clothes. All right, how are you gonna wash them? You're gonna collect water and then you're gonna beat them. Fine, they're going to dry outside because it's really hot, but it's hours of
I
manual
think you
labor.
mentioned
Would you
Hans Rosling
rather?
in this,
Yeah.
in
Would you
his
rather
magic
do
washing
that?
machine.
Would you rather do that, or would you rather have a washing machine do it? Would you rather have a fridge that keeps the food in it? Would you rather have a supermarket or a grocer's where you could get food? Well, how are you going to do that? You'd have to have a job. Would you rather have the choice to pursue your dreams, to attempt to do the things that fulfill you and make you happy? Which is where the human capital comes in, right? Because you don't get that from people doing things they hate. No, you don't. You get that from people having curiosity and passion and working hard because they want to, because they have a skill, They have a dream. They want to. If, which would you choose?
There's no
Nobody.
doubt in my mind.
Nobody. Nobody. When I've put it that way, nobody, even the people who are saying live on that, they're not really thinking about those things. And that's without looking at the net real negatives, like would you rather, you know, children that survive infancy or children that are at so much risk of a snake bite or a dog bite and dying from rabies or something else gets them, even just they break an arm, they get an infection and you don't have antibiotics. Fine, you know, maybe someone gives you money and you could buy antibiotics. How are you going to store them without a fridge in 40 degree heat? Like, you know, in 104 Fahrenheit degree heat. It's a no-brainer. No one really wants to live like that. And there is a danger to romanticizing it because so many people do. And I think that is because, you know, they're not happy with something in their lives. But that's the thing. We can always change that. We have opportunity that allows us to change that. And I know there's still different degrees of it. And I know people still struggle. You know, people still struggle in the UK, but it's just, it's on a different level. There's a level of opportunity that is unimaginable if you go back to living the way that you think we should be living. And
yeah,
you know,
I'm
it's
like,
almost, it's almost a war on nature when you think about it. We've really romanticized nature. Nature is what kills people. Technology is the equalizer.
Yes.
Because if you're fighting a virus or anything, if you're fighting pesticides, the pests that are going to eat all your crops, you have nothing to eat or sell. You're fighting nature. Technology and science are the equalizers.
You've used the word agency an awful lot, which is important. It's we have opportunities and we have the agency to choose and take advantage of those opportunities. And it's a heck of a lot better to at least have that than to be in a place where you don't have any choices. You have to do things on a day-to-day basis just to survive. And that's what I think, you
and
know, I took that out of your book. It's so
and that's
important.
Exactly why my parents, they don't want to move back there. They would be rich there. They would be millionaires there, right? Because it's so cheap. They could live in a city and they could visit the village. So they could have a bit of a better quality of life because the cities are, you know, Delhi's very developed comparatively. But the risks are still quite immense. The risks are still there. The discomfort's still there. The inconvenience is still there. Here, you know, they potter around in their little house. They don't have extremes of weather to deal with. You know, they don't have to ration electricity when it's cold. They put the heating on. Potter around in the garden, love gardening. Gardening's a fun pastime here. Things aren't going to bite you and kill you. We don't have anything in this country that's deadly. I know we're very sheltered, but you know, they just don't have the worries. But even if they did, you know, even if we did have those things, they could get treated very easily. There's so much agency. You don't even have to think twice about it. You don't have to think, well, I better not go outside in the long grass because something might bite me and I'll die, right? You don't have to, it's a different, when I say agency, I'm really thinking about a different way of thinking that you can't develop if you grow up in true scarcity. You can't develop it. And I really felt that in the villages when I was trying to encourage people, say, you know, we took books with us, we took pencils with us, I was showing people how to hold pencils because the kids just hold them like sticks. They don't know how to hold a pencil. They've never seen it before. They've never seen a pencil before. So trying to kind of help them. And they would say, what, why? This isn't going to help me on the farm. This isn't going to help me when I have children of my own. This isn't, you know, and I couldn't really communicate it. I couldn't communicate what education and developing critical thinking has done for me. And the vast world that it opens up to you, which is an incredible world full of opportunity, I just couldn't communicate it. And it made me really sad because I want them to have that because everybody deserves to have that as far as possible, right?
Yes, I agree. Hey, Zianna, I'm going to offer you the opportunity for this. It's close to a concluding remark there, but I'll let you say, is there anything else you'd like to share about your book, about your activities now and what you really see is happening in the near future?
So I wrote the book because I felt like we won the arguments in a lot of areas, particularly around nuclear. But it's not just about one technology or this technology. It is about rethinking thinking about what it took for us to get here and thinking about it differently and telling a different story, not just the negative story of the cost to nature or the cost to the environment or the cost of burning fossil fuels, but the good sides and the good things and the reasons that we did that. And I do think that's really important to stay grounded, that the reasons we did that is because they have improved life on so many levels. And, you know, I could have written a super technical book. I thought about it. There's quite a few already out there on nuclear, really technical books. And we need them too. But the people that read them tend to already agree, you know, with the data. I didn't want to write just a book about data. It's narrative nonfiction because I'm trying to tell a different story. And I hope that people can read that and in some way help develop their thinking around what it means to really imagine a world where poverty doesn't exist, where scarcity is not desirable by anyone, and where abundance doesn't come at a cost to the planet, because it doesn't have to. Abundance can go hand in hand with protecting environment, nature, people, because I feel like that's where the conversation could really go. But there's no one pushing that propaganda, right? Like, there aren't multiple elements coming together pushing that propaganda. What I still see is a lot of pushback. And I would love for people to take those ideas to help push the conversation forward even further, because I'm sure there's a lot even I'm missing there of what we could be aiming for, of how we could improve things. And it's not just about this country should build X number of reactors. Like, we have experts in industries who can do that bit already. We have world leaders who can make those decisions. It's much wider than that, I think, about where do we want to go as a species? What do we want? What do we actually want the future to look like? And that, you know, to me, that is abundance. But maybe I use abundance in a slightly different way to the kind of common way that it's used, that it means taking everyone with us and using human agency for the benefit of people and the planet.
That's great. That's a terrific way to conclude. I do want to remind people that the book that we've been talking about is Energy is Life. And I bought my copy off of Amazon. Zian, can you tell us any place else that people should go to look if they want to find your book?
Yeah, you can get it in any bookstore. The only thing is the shipping is slow. If you want a physical copy, the shipping is slow in the US. I have had some complaints about this, just because it's a UK publisher, but the Kindle version you can get immediately, and it's available everywhere. You don't have to buy it off of Amazon, any
Terrific.
Bookstore.
All right. I know that there's a lot of people push back against Amazon, but for me, that's abundance. It shows up on my doorstep, and usually within a day, sometimes in the same day, but that's just life. All right. I am privileged. I live in a very nice community with lots of access to good delivery services and electricity whenever I need to turn on a light. So, or turn on a computer or a washing machine, or even, dare I say it, a spa heat pump.
Wow. Amazing.
Hey. Yep. Life is good. All right. Thank you very much, Zian, and have a terrific day.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adam's way.